Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly programme for people who feel disconnected from church. You might go to church, but you might not. It's not that you've got a bone to pick with Jesus, but what goes on in church sometimes isn't really about following him. On today's podcast, Peter Mockford joins me to discuss why, as a full-time vicar, he wanted to become a fully licensed psychotherapist. What is a psychotherapist? We'll find out later on. And also, what he has noticed about the behaviour of Christians and churchgoers before, during and after lockdown. Good morning to you, Peter.
Morning, Martin.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Obviously, before we go into the nuts and bolts of what a psychotherapist is and the difference between a psychotherapist, a therapist, physiotherapist and anything else, adding in ist, I'd be careful there. Let's go for five questions so we can get a better understanding of who is Peter Mockford and what makes him tick. Here we go. Question one. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask him questions, who would it be?
Well, I don't know, really. I mean, I puzzled over this one, and I'm not really too sure, so I just pull it out of my hat, you know. I think I'd be very interested to kind of have one of the popes, I think.
Okay. Any particular one?
Well, the current one is very interesting because he obviously strikes me as a man of great integrity. Mm. And I'd just be very interested to talk to him.
Excellent. Maybe over a glass of wine or something like that.
Yeah, and being Catholic, he's bound to have a few, you know, up for a few glasses and we'll take it from there. You
know? In his private wine cellar. Question two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable?
Oh, I think Balaam's ass has to be my favourite character.
Because?
Well, because this ass stuck to its guns. It didn't, you know, it wasn't fazed by anything.
Very true. That's actually a serious answer, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It shows that animals sometimes have more wisdom than humans. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I've seen a few donkeys play football as well, especially for my team in the past.
Yeah, well, I have a Labrador and she's smart.
Question three. This would be interesting. If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
Right. I thought about this one. I thought, really, we've got to have a law or something that really tightens up on the issue of integrity. The nonsense that we've had over the last few years is just, you know, ridiculous. So we've got to have something that actually allows us to have people who are in Parliament who actually have integrity.
Give us an example then, what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, I think it's obvious that, you know, we've had all the kind of Partygate stuff and so on and so forth during COVID. And I think at the end of the day, you know, Parliament ought to be really clear that if you lay down laws and you break them, that's the end of your representation.
I can hear a big amen to that going across the planet as we speak. Question four, outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
Oh, I don't know. I was thinking of one recently where it was incredibly warm down on the Dorset coast. And it was just brilliant. And there was hardly anybody there because it was 7 a.m. And just swimming in relatively warm water.
Wow.
So that was fantastic.
Well, I live in Northern Ireland now. You must come try it over here. Not.
No, quite. Far too cold. And well, wet.
Yes, very wet and very cold. Although there'd be people who say, no, we enjoy it. We enjoy it. We go out every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, not
for me. I'm not into wild swimming.
No.
It's one of these things I think you ought to be into, but I really can't pluck up the kind of courage to do it.
No, I'm not even involved in any kind of swimming these days. Just getting wet doesn't do me.
Well, you don't have to, you know. You can have a cold shower each morning.
Well, I do when I play golf over here. It's called rain. Question five. What has been your most embarrassing moment?
Oh, I've no idea, mate. I gave up on that question the minute I saw it. I just thought, there's far too many, so let's just pass on that one.
I'll ask your wife. That might be interesting. Well, thank you for that, Peter. We've got a better understanding of that you've got a good sense of humour, which is good. And as I said, later on at the end of the podcast, we'll find out who your Christian hero is. Really looking forward to that. Meantime, let's get more into who you are as well, if that's okay, please.
Okay.
Before you became a vicar and before you became a psychotherapist, You used to have involvement with coffee. What was all that about?
Yes, I worked for a coffee company in Kenya, and I was predominantly involved in setting up new businesses across East Africa. So in Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and what was then Zaire. And those were predominantly non-coffee businesses and involved everything from drying fruit to processing chemicals to all sorts of things.
Wow. How long were you over there for?
7 years. I was brought up in Africa. I was brought up in Uganda as a child.
Oh, were you?
And then I went back to and lived in Kenya and worked for this company, setting up these various businesses around East Africa.
Wow. I know nothing about Uganda other than I think, wasn't it Winston Churchill who said it was the breadbasket of all Africa or something like that?
It's an astonishing country. Astonishing country. I mean, I was brought up there as a child. But my parents had to flee due to Idi Amin. And so that's when we ended up back in England.
Got you. What were your parents doing over there?
They were actually Church Missionary Society missionaries.
Oh, right.
They were predominantly working in the slums of Kampala, planting churches there.
Wow. Have you been back there at all?
When I worked back in Kenya, I used to work go in and out of Uganda. It was a bit dicey at that time because it was in the middle of a civil war.
Yeah.
But that was actually to do with the coffee business. But I haven't been back there for a good number of years now.
Wow. Be interesting for you to go back, I think. Maybe make a documentary. Peter Mockford revisits Uganda.
No. I'll leave the broadcasting to you, sir.
Yeah. So from coffee beans then, what made you go into the church?
Well, that's an interesting story. I'll give you the potted version.
Yeah.
I was working in Western Kenya. And opposite where we were living was a big shanty town. And in the middle of this shanty town was this Catholic church run by a guy called Hans Bergman, who was sent there as punishment by the Catholic Church in those days because he was the vicar general of the Mill Hill Fathers. So he was very high up in the Catholic hierarchy, but he was very outspoken.
Sorry, what were they called? The Mill Hill Fathers, did you say?
Yes, the Mill Hill Fathers.
Should I know anything about them?
Not really, but it's one of the big orders in the Catholic Church.
Okay.
Basically, he set up this church based on nothing. He spoke the local language. He did communion. He broke the rules. He did communion with chapatis and tea.
Wow.
But it was a church in the shanty, and the shanty towns were places where the rejects of African society ended up.
Yes.
So incredibly poor, incredibly violent. And this church was in the middle of it. And it was the place where God moved. There was no health care, so he prayed for people, they got healed.
Wow.
It was well over 2,000 people who attended the church and so on. And because we were living quite close to him, I used to help him out occasionally setting up various projects. And used to have long chats with him at night with a hurricane lamp and warm beer, and the mosquitoes buzzing around. One day he said to me, "Well, Peter, when are you going to start doing what you're supposed to do?" And I didn't really fancy the Catholic Church too much, you know. The celibacy thing didn't really appeal. So I opted for the Anglican Church, you know.
All because of that.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're still in Uganda, so where did you do
I was in Kenya. I was in Kenya.
Oh, Kenya, sorry, Kenya, yeah. Yeah. Apologies. So you then felt you had to go into the church. So where did you study?
I studied at Durham. So I did my theology degree in Durham and my Anglican training in Durham. And then I ended up as a curate in Tamworth for 6 years and then in Stoke-on-Trent.
Got you. When you say Durham, I remember in the 80s, the Bishop of Durham making headlines. Was that during your tenure?
No, it wasn't. He just left.
Right.
He made headlines. But on the plus side about him making headlines, at least he did make headlines and got people talking.
Yeah, I can't remember what he was making headlines for, mind you. But
he was on the extremely liberal side of the church.
Okay. Moving that aside then. So being a vicar then, highs and lows of being a vicar.
I, I, I think it's a brilliant calling if one's called to it, because actually you see people at all sorts of stages of life and all sorts of difficulties and also in all sorts of joys and, you know, and great occasions and so on. And you see God moving. And I think that's one of the great joys of it. Mm. One of the great downsides of it is that the, you know, when God moves, as somebody said to me, when the Holy Spirit moves, all spirits move. And the reality is that, you know, when God moves, and we saw God moving in many different ways, it also brings up a lot of trauma and hurt in people that needs to be addressed and so on. I think one of the downsides is how do you cope with that? How do you cope with the level of pain that comes up, which is actually as a direct result of God's blessing? Because as God blesses and the Spirit is poured out, actually the wounds come to the surface. Mm. So actually they need to be addressed. But I have to say, I mean, that, so in terms of stress, it was fairly kind of major, but great joys as well.
Yeah, you talk about all the joys and the blessings. I think in the Bible it talks also about curses as well. Is there a correlation between curses and blessings?
Well, they're the flip side of each other. But I think for, I mean, that was the other thing about that whole time in Stoke-on-Trent. I was heavily involved in the deliverance ministry. Mm. And for the last 4 or 5 years, I ran the Dyson deliverance team there. And I think one of the things that was very clear is that actually in our society, we don't tend to take that desperately seriously in the Christian church. And we actually need to do so. That directly led on to the fact that how do you tell whether something is demonic and how do you determine whether something is actually psychological?
Yeah.
Because it's quite important to make sure that you get it right, because how you then deal with it is really important, because you can do a lot of damage by thinking it's one thing and not the other.
Yes.
And that directly led to the Lord really saying to me, look, Peter, you've got to train as a secular psychotherapist, because you've got to find out what the world knows about relationships and how kind of human beings operate. Because unless you're actually qualified, people are not going to take you seriously when it comes to the deliverance ministry either.
Yeah.
So that directly led to 4.5 years training as a psychotherapist while I was still a vicar, which was pretty hard really to kind of get the two working, you know, be able to do that. But I was very fortunate at the time because we had a fairly large staff. So overall, I think it was a real blessing to do the psychotherapy as well. Even if I hadn't practiced psychotherapy, actually the sheer wisdom and actually what the world knew about, you know, the secular world knows about relationships is critically important.
Yeah.
I think what I find bizarre, and I really find bizarre, is that the Church of Christ, which is actually in theory based on relationships, never properly studied it, never properly looked at the dynamics. How come it was left to the secular world to work out, you know, how these things work? And I find it very strange that at the root of the Christian faith, which is relationships both with Christ and with one another, that we never really looked at it and how it properly works and how what the dynamics are. And we left it, in a sense, to the secular world. And actually, the whole thing about psychotherapy was that it came out of both the Jewish and the Christian traditions, mm-hmm. because all the major figures in psychotherapy tend to come out of one of those two traditions.
Okay.
So I think the psychotherapy and the deliverance ministry going together and the church was actually a very kind of good cross-fertilization, really.
Yeah. Well, looking at deliverance, I mean, when you mention deliverance ministries, most people, I think, immediately think of the Hollywood type deliverance type ministries that we see on TV and on films today. What's your description of deliverance ministry?
It's one of the odd things, but I think it's much more straightforward than people think it is.
Okay.
Because the issue is not so much the deliverance ministry, though that has to be addressed, but it's more why is it there in the first place? If you look at how Jesus did the deliverance ministry, it was actually very straightforward. It wasn't a big deal. It was a deliverance. It was a ministry of just pure power. In fact, it's the only place in the Bible where you'll actually read that Jesus says the kingdom of God is among you. It's the kingdom of God is not, you know, normally the kingdom of God is near, the kingdom of God is, you know, coming in its fullness, except in the deliverance ministry, which is actually a ministry of actually the ultimate, you know, straight authority of God, the kingdom of God is here. So moving in that grace and in that power and in that relationship with Christ, actually, I believe every Christian needs to operate in that kind of authority.
Okay. Could we call you then an exorcist? Would that be right? Because?
Well, because of the film, really. I think it got such a bad name. I mean, and, you know, quite honestly, you can't land anybody with that title these days.
No, exactly. Deliverance Ministries, then. No doubt you've heard of some horror stories of people who think, oh, I can do this. That person's got a demon. I can cast them out. What's your feeling on that?
Okay, my feeling is that when the deliverance ministry, in a sense, it goes to two extremes, the deliverance ministry. Well, on one extreme, you've got those who say, well, it doesn't exist. It's all psychological. And it goes on the other extreme where everything is demonic and needs delivering. I think one of the problems with the deliverance ministry is it's very easy for people, number one, to get frightened. And therefore, if you get frightened, you tend to get aggressive and shout.
Yeah.
And I've seen people shouting and doing all sorts of things. I was thinking, look, that's really unnecessary. And all that's happening is that they're operating out of their own sense of fear.
Okay.
And so I haven't got a great deal of time for that, really, because you shouldn't be in the deliverance ministry if actually, you know, you get frightened or worried about it. I mean, it's always a bit concerning, but that's a very different kettle of fish from, you know, being frightened.
Yeah.
And the other thing you've got to remember about the deliverance ministry, it's fundamentally related to our relationship with Christ. We can't do anything outside of the relationship with God, with Christ. I mean, Jesus himself said, you know, you can only do what the Father, he only does what the Father has shown him to do. You know, the Father's going ahead of him. And in the same way, in the deliverance ministry, it's all about being able to hear what God is actually saying at this time for this person to bring freedom and release.
Yes. But you wouldn't recommend people to do it ordinarily, or would you?
My personal feeling is that it's one of these ministries, in the same way as we've encouraged people to pray for healing for one another and so on, we need to pray for, you know, we need to encourage people to kind of pray for deliverance if they think it's there. But, and I would encourage actually people to, but with a very big proviso, that actually, you know, they do look at the kind of the biblical material and they do get the proper teaching, because actually, you can cause a lot of damage in the deliverance ministry if you don't know what you're doing. And the big issue is this psychological, and how is this linked to the demonic? Because most of the time, the issue is not so much the demonic. You can get rid of the demonic relatively easily. It's how do you deal with why it is there in the first place?
Generally speaking, why is that?
Well, several things about that. One is that actually it's the Proverbs bit, you know, an undeserved curse, you know, doesn't land unless actually, you know, there's a reason for it.
Okay.
And I think with the demonic, it's you won't get the demonic unless there's a reason there, unless there's an area there that it can attach to. Hmm. And sometimes it's just hurt and pain. And the other thing about it, I'd say about it is that the demonic is there for a good reason. You know, the demonic is not omnipresent, not like God.
Right.
So it's there for a specific reason. And therefore, those people who are particularly vulnerable are those involved in churches that are actually involved in proclaiming the gospel, those churches that are living as Christ actually asked us to do and sharing his love and grace. But that makes people potentially vulnerable to the demonic because the demonic doesn't want it there.
So if somebody phoned you up and said, oh, I believe I've had a spiritual warfare attack, what's the likelihood that that actually is true? Or conversely, you know, it was just a psychological thing?
depends. Well, you'd have to listen very, very carefully and see where they're coming from, to be honest.
Yeah.
And also what kind of church they're involved in and why they're there and why they think it's demonic. I mean, the big danger from a psychological viewpoint is that people project their fears onto the demonic as a way of not facing the stuff they really need to face in themselves.
Can you give us an example?
Well, for example, if someone says, well, I got a spirit of fear, well, that's an interesting one. Well, first of all, why have you got a spirit of fear? You know, what fear is it actually attached to? And, you know, are you facing that? Are you realizing what that's about? Because, you know, we can get rid of the demonic very easily, but if we don't deal with the underlying causes, then it's, you know, it's what's written in Matthew, you know, you clean out the house, but you leave all the windows open.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose it's a bit like an alcoholic saying, right, we'll take all your beer away. You've taken away the source, but you haven't actually created the to find out what the symptoms were that made him go to alcohol in the first place.
Correct.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Before we move on, because I am fascinated by what you're sharing here, and hopefully others are getting a better insight into it. Ghosts, hauntings, things like that. Going to a house and people say, it's a haunted house, or I feel it's haunted, or a sudden cold thing came across me. What do you think?
It can be. It can be. I mean, I think you run into huge theological difficulties here because, you know, traditional theology says, okay, when you die, you know, you go into the hands of the Lord or whatever it is, or you go, or the opposite. But you don't hang around. But I would say practically, I've seen that actually it's a bit like when people have trauma in their lives, they can't move on, they get stuck. And they constantly replay the trauma instead of coming to terms with it and moving on. That's what post-traumatic stress disorder is, by the way.
Right.
They continually replay. And I think it's very much the same sometimes with when people die, if there's unresolved trauma, they actually can't move on, even though they died. And that in those situations, you can get situations where I actually believe human spirits can be in houses.
Maybe we could talk about that at a later date as well.
That's a completely separate subject.
It is. That's what I think. Right. Well, great. We'll park that and come back maybe in some months' time talk about it. You alluded earlier on that you had a great team in Stoke-on-Trent and you were able to go and do your psychotherapy course. Perhaps you could tell us exactly what the difference is between a psychotherapist, a psychologist, psycho this, psycho that, and anything else ending in ist, please.
Okay. First of all, everything started off as one.
Okay.
So when you look at the founding fathers of psychotherapy, psychology, psychiatry, it's all one lump. And it's, you know, because that's how Freud and Jung developed it. Because originally it came out, they were medical doctors, went into psychiatry, but also into therapy at the same time. So it was all one system, really.
Okay.
But what those areas fundamentally refer to is specialisms. So in psychiatry, you're talking predominantly about a medical approach to how you deal with mental health. So that would involve particularly the use of drugs, antidepressants and so on. And when you look at psychology, you're looking predominantly at how the environment is affecting it and what kind of differences you can make to actually change your environment or behavioral differences that you can make that actually will result in greater peace and internally. If you look at psychotherapy, what it says is that this is a lot of the issues that arose, you know, that caused trauma arose because of actually badly functioning relationships, particularly when young, that affected how the brain developed and how you actually develop various neuron links and so on. And actually in relationship and by talking things through or by using the relationship with the therapist, you can actually resolve that and actually change the way and come to terms with trauma. They're three, and the areas all tend to overlap slightly.
But you, I take it, aren't allowed to prescribe drugs.
No.
Right. For people who...
Well, I'd have to say that's not the normal practice, for example, in America. So in America, psychiatrists normally train as psychotherapists as well. So they are both together. And when I did my training as a psychotherapist, we had a couple of psychiatrists on the course as well. So, you know, it's an overlap. But no, certainly in Europe and in the UK, registered psychotherapists cannot prescribe.
If you had identical twins with the same problems, and one went to a psychotherapist and one went to a psychologist, one was given drugs, one went through, you know, how you would do it, what would be the end result?
No idea.
Well, have we got some twins out there that would like...
Well, no idea. But I think one of the things is that it's, you know, the brain is one of these things that we just don't, is right on the frontiers. Mm. We don't really understand how things operate. We know often certain things have certain effects, but we don't understand why they do.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that's really important about psychotherapy and even about psychiatry and psychology is actually finding out what actually works for that person. Because what works for one person won't necessarily work for another.
Yes. Got you. I'm glad you mentioned the American system, because I remember as a school kid growing up, reading newspaper, and you'd read all about these actors and actresses going to see their therapist. You know, and there was always, from a UK point of view, it was maybe it was snobbery, I don't know, just laughing. Why you go to see a therapist? We don't have that over here. What has changed over the past 20, 30 years for people to suddenly embrace, if that's a better word, to go and see a therapist?
Well, I think the bottom line is that in the UK, for some reason, and I think this is cultural, we have a horror and a fear of emotion.
Hmm.
And therefore, anything that kind of smacks of emotional openness and dealing with that kind of reality, we shy away from. And I think the Americans were actually light years ahead of us with this. And I think that one of the reasons they were so far ahead of us is the Vietnam War.
Hmm.
Is that they saw what happened to people and they realized that you actually got to deal with this.
Yes.
And the truth is that I think the British culture of having a stiff upper lip, not dealing with our emotions and so on, has resulted in horrendous consequences in terms of dysfunctional families and so on. And I think it's only now that we're beginning to say to people, look, rationalism has not got the answer. You've got to deal with actually your emotional environment, both internally and externally, and actually genuinely engage. And so I think people are finally getting the message.
Okay.
That actually you've got to deal, you can deal with this stuff. Stuff can be dealt with, and it can be, and you can move on. You don't have to continually carry the rage, the anger, the despair. Actually, you can work this through.
Wouldn't it be fair to say also that some people actually genuinely like to carry their rage with them?
No.
Okay.
I would, because rage and anger is a defensive mechanism against pain. So if someone's got a lot of anger and rage, underneath it, they've also got incredible pain. So because pain and anger are flip sides of the same coin. So if you've got the anger and the rage there, you've got the pain there. And nobody in their right mind wants to kind of continually live with the pain. However, people may not be prepared to face the pain and may prefer to actually keep the anger and the rage going. But the price that you will pay for doing so is dramatic in terms of the relationships you will then form. Because
yes.
You will not be able to form life-giving relationships.
Yes. I hear that. I hear that. before I come to the Christian side of this, that's okay, Pete. One final thing on the chemical imbalance I hear people mention these days in their brains. Their individual brain. How do tablets actually work to make you feel better?
Nobody knows.
Really?
Yeah. Well, they vaguely know. They vaguely know serotonin uptake inhibitors. The amount of serotonin you have in your system can actually get excessive and therefore needs to be reduced. And that's behind a lot of the SSRIs.
Sorry, SSRIs?
Antidepressants.
Okay.
So we generally know a lot of these. We know what can work. But you see, if you take antidepressants, for example,
yeah,
any one antidepressant is only 30% effective, you know, effective in 30% of the population. So you need so what doctors have is actually a number of antidepressants, and they have to find the right one for you because yeah, there's no guarantee that one will work. So there are no, it's a much vaguer science in some ways because we simply don't know, but we know some things, and you know, it just depends on the situation and the case.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was also, I suppose, yeah, again, going back to my school years growing up, if you said you were on antidepressants, that'd be a real stigma against you. Would I be right in saying that stigma's more or less vanished now from UK society?
I hope so. I'm not entirely convinced it has, but I would hope so. I think what is really frightening, though, and this brings me back to the church to a certain extent, is that, you know, I was looking at the Mind figures recently, you know, the health charity, the mental health charity, yeah, Mind, and they were saying at any one point, 20% of the population will have mental health issues.
Wow.
Now, you're talking about a substantial number of people.
Yeah.
So you're talking, if you've got a congregation of 100, you know, 20%, 20 people there are going to have either facing mental health issues, be on medication, be in therapy or whatever. So it's a huge issue in terms of both the church and society.
I think I know what you're going to say to this, so please temper your response. I'm sure there'll be a few Christians listening today say, oh, yes, but I don't need to go and see a therapist because I've got Jesus. Yeah, he'll help me out with all my mental health issues, which I haven't got, obviously. What would you say?
I'm trying to temper my language so you don't have to censor this or write it out. What I would say is this. I deal with predominantly, as a psychotherapist at the moment, I see mainly Christian ministers,
wow,
and their families who need psychotherapy. I have to say that the demand has never been higher in the 15 years I've been practicing.
Wow.
And hardly a week goes by without a minister trying to get hold of me of every denomination.
I'm glad you said that. I was wondering whether it's just for the Anglicans.
No. Because I'm also involved in the church's ministerial counselling service, which covers all the denominations.
Okay.
I would say that if people need help, get help. You know, it's a bit like saying, I don't need to see a doctor because God will heal me.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck with that one, Sancho.
Why do you say that?
Well, because I think some of the hardest situations I've faced have actually been Pentecostal ministers.
Really?
Who would hold that kind of view.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, prayer, you know, and everything else and so on. In fact, I always remember, you know, many years ago dealing with a Pentecostal minister. And I said to him, you know, what have you been preaching on Sunday? He said, well, I was preaching about, you know, God healing and so on and so forth. I said, right, so why are you sitting here?
And he said?
He didn't really know what to say. And I said, actually, there needs to become a realization that God can use many ways of healing. And actually, therapy, psychotherapy, psychology, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, may well be that.
Yeah. You mentioned
Christian. Don't limit it to a particular way of, you know, if I get prayer, it'll be okay. That's just nonsense.
I said earlier on, to allude what you were saying about, you know, the alcohol, you take the beer away, you haven't actually confronted the reasons why he or she turned to alcohol. Mm-hmm. Was it, from what you've been seeing over the past 15 years then, and talking to ministers of all persuasions, and they come to see you because they're obviously burnt out, which is the classic line they use now?
No, it's not they're burnt out. Actually, they're in psychological, they're in real trouble. So it could be, you know, all sorts of things come up. When the fabric of the psyche comes under stress, then stress gets too high. And actually, you know, talking about the pandemic, actually it's put church ministers under all sorts of different kinds of stress.
Yeah.
It mean, and if that is continually kind of unrelenting, then what you'll find is when it stops, there's normally a lag phase of about 6 months. Now, I've managed to get through that. That was brilliant and so on and so forth. And you've had all your defences to keep operating and so on. That's great. But then after 6 months or so, you start to relax your defences and suddenly all the stuff you were holding starts coming to the surface. So it could be fear, anxiety, depression, could be any of these things. And it just starts flooding up into the system. And at that point, you need to get help.
Is there a particular trigger? The reason I'm asking is that my wife for years suffered with ME, and they generally think that that's due to a particular cause. You might have had the flu and then some major mental problem as well, as in what was going on in the family or outside of the family, in a job, whatever, and that triggered the shutdown. How does that apply in this case?
Well, I think, first of all, there used to be an argument that it was either genetic or it was environmental.
Okay.
That has been laid to bed now. That argument doesn't even register, because we know now that the environment affects the genetics. So environmentally, your experience of the environment turns some of your genes on and off.
Right. Like in the winter, we don't get the sun, we feel a bit meh.
Yeah, and that can be just to switch the genes in a particular way and whatever it is. So, yeah. First of all, the argument about environment versus genetics is, you know, everything's one, really. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to things like kind of ME and so on, you've got a whole host of issues that are kind of combined. Now, I'm not entirely convinced that ME is... I think obviously environmental factors play a part. I think a lot of it is due, from the research I've seen, you know, to actually a virus, for example, that's never kind of properly got away and has major effects mentally. But, you know, I mean, psychotherapy may be helpful there. I don't know is the answer. It just depends on each individual case. And if you've got a situation whereby an individual has specific trauma and, you know, has suffered from, a virus infection, so the two may well be interacting.
Yeah.
In which case, you actually have to deal with both at the same time.
Got you. Right. Well, I did say earlier on that we'll talk about what you've noticed about the behaviour of Christians pre, during and post-lockdown. So... first of all, obviously, I don't want you to give your political comment on what you thought lockdown was all about. But what's your overall opinion as to where Christians are prior to lockdown and where they are now?
Well, I think I want to dodge the question slightly. What I really want to kind of say is, what was God saying through lockdown? What was God saying to the church?
Okay.
Because I think that's absolutely critical. Because unless we look at that and each church asks itself the question, what was God saying to the church? What changes need to be put into place? And how do we need to go forward? And what, you know, how is God leading us forward? You know, these things really do have to be addressed. I think what worries me more than anything else is that when churches simply go back to what they were doing.
Yes.
Because that patently, you know, will we please look at the figures? It is not working. You know, the reality is church attendance is slipping all the time. And actually, what we're doing was not working. And actually, it was almost as though God was saying, look, why don't you really have a look at this and start asking the questions about how do we go forward? What is God calling us to? How are we going to serve our communities and be the light? You know, what is going to happen? What? How are we going to address this?
Yeah.
And I think it's much easier if you're not in a if you're in a church that is not hidebound by tradition or hidebound by and I mean tradition in a funny way. I don't mean just the traditional churches, but churches have a tendency to stick with what they know.
Yes. And that's wisdom. That's wisdom as well, though, isn't it?
It depends on the situation, of course.
Hmm.
If what you were doing was not working and people were not coming to Christ and actually there was not a growth in discipleship and growth in understanding and so on, then you have to say, well, is it really working? And I'm not sure you can say it is.
If we go back about 120, 130 years, right, you had one day off in a week. Yep. And that would be a Sunday, and you expect to go to church. Although by this time, people love playing football. In fact, going back more than that, 150 years, something like that, 160 years. And the result of which was that quite a few churches realised that they were losing their men coming into a church on Sunday morning. So what did they do? They went and formed their own football teams.
Yeah.
And the result is, well, I think Southampton, you can name that, yeah. Everton, Liverpool, you can name loads of professional football teams today.
I'm glad you mentioned football. Particularly Liverpool. Yeah, go on. Yes.
Who do you support then?
Liverpool.
Do you?
Yeah, I was brought up in Liverpool.
Well, I never knew that.
I remember going to the Kop when I was 4 years old.
Wow. And what was the first game?
I can't remember.
Can you remember the score?
No, I can just remember having to be on my father's shoulders because otherwise I couldn't see a damn thing.
Well, I won't tell you who I support, but we did beat you in the FA Cup once, and I was there. Yeah. But but that's the thing, isn't it? That, you know, they decided to do something about it.
Yeah.
So if God was talking to certain church leaders during lockdown, something has to change, and they came to you, what would you say?
It's not up to me to say, because they have to hear what God is saying to their church, to their people.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would say is be open to what God is saying. Be flexible, because actually one of the difficulties is if you're not flexible, then you're never going to hear what God's saying in any case.
Yeah.
Because actually, if he says something that you can't hear, you know, that's so unacceptable or you're not flexible enough to hear it, then it's a waste of time. So what I would really say to people is, look, you know, be open, be flexible and genuinely seek what God wants to do.
Point taken. Okay, so looking at what's been going on then over the past 2-3 years, and for people that have come to see you, Christianity today, you're saying it's slipping, and for me personally, that's why I thought it'd be a good idea to do something called off-grid Christianity, because I seem to be meeting more and more people who are not enjoying church and just can't be bothered to go to church anymore. But haven't lost their faith. What do you think?
I get that completely. I think it was about 2 years ago, a lady called Ruth Perrin, who's a lecturer in Durham,
mm-hmm.
Wrote a book called Changing Shape, where she analysed what people wanted from church who actually were Christians. And what she came up with was the fact that the vast majority of churches are simply not providing this. So actually people are coming out of church, and actually because why prop up an institution? This is supposed to be about living faith.
Mm.
And the churches are not providing it. And she put her finger on a number of things. Number one, she said, look, there's got to be authenticity. Now, authenticity, you know, people have got to, you know, walk the walk as well as talk the talk. Secondly, she said, actually, there's got to be room and open for exchange of views. Now, that doesn't fit very well. You know, if you believe that you've got the truth, actually, how are you going to sit down and have an open discussion with people But if you're more flexible than that and say, okay, right, look, I know what I believe. I believe it's the truth, but let's discuss it, see what you think, and we'll, you know, maybe we'll both walk away from here changed as a result of being open and hearing from one another. And she was saying that, that particularly younger people do, you know, need to be heard and need to have a place to be heard. The third thing she said was actually the you need genuine relationships.
Yeah.
And I think that's the real crunch, you know, with a lot of these things, that it's very difficult. How do you form genuine relationships? And the model of church that we have, whereby, you know, it's Sunday attendance or whatever, doesn't fit easily into that. Because, first of all, for a lot of people, it's a lousy time.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, there's too many people to relate to in any case.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, the thing about age groups, you know, we're slipping slowly, slowly short. You know, we're kind of losing the 20s, 30s, 40s. So they're not going to come to a church that's actually, they can't relate, you know, to a bunch of kind of 70, you know, 60, 70 year olds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so you, we've got to look at it, I think, much more in relational terms and say, okay, so look, how did Jesus do it? I mean, he was the worst church builder that's ever happened. You know, if you tell 500 people to get lost and go back to Galilee. You know, I mean, he really focused around the 12.
Yes.
And I do think that actually one of the things that I think God is saying is that if you're going to have a focus on relationships with both with me and with one another, you've got to look at how do you facilitate that in the church scenario. I think I've heard of some very, very interesting kind of developments, really, you know, including, you know, one church I know that have cut their Sunday services to once or twice a month and actually put the focus on groups in the community, you know, meeting together, praying together, and then these groups then operate, do their own children's work and so on and so forth. And they're only, you know, 12 or 13. And so they operate as small units of church within their communities. And that strikes me as, you know, much more in line with, you know, what Christ had originally.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have to say, Peter, you know, I have met many people, that's not quite grammatically correct, but you know what I mean, over the past year, who I knew to be committed Christians, but for one reason or other, aren't going back to church now, and are obviously feeling really disillusioned with the church, as in the building, the denomination or whatever, but they haven't lost their faith. What would you say?
I would say, look, the fundamental thing about Christianity is actually that you're in relationship with God and in relationship with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot do it solo. You have to be within community somehow. And the reality is that actually and this is really dicey, you know, because it means the church has got to take huge risks. You know, there's got to be huge risks involved in this. But I think if we were thinking much more in terms of relational units, you know, about relating to one another, you know, and actually having different age groups in the same group and so on and so forth. And so there was cross-fertilization of ideas and listening to one another and so on.
Mm.
You know, there's nothing new in this. This has been around for a long time. But I think the failure of the institutions in the main have been that they have not been relational. Relational in terms of actually the relationship with Christ, they bang on and bang on about it. But actually the relationships with one another seems to be left to the side a lot. And actually the two go hand in hand. The two work together. And that's what Jesus said, actually.
So we're talking about fellowship and relationship can be the same thing?
Yeah.
Okay. So the people that are listening today then are saying, yeah, that really makes sense, but I still can't go into a building. What can they do?
Well, I would simply say, okay, so if you can't do, there's going to be lots of others of you feeling the same.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Maybe you know another couple or, you know, someone else you know, in an equal position, you know, from the same church and so on. How about meeting together just for prayer? How about meeting together just to kind of support one another? It doesn't have to be anything heavy. Just support one another, pray for one another, and just see then how it grows. Because other people will be fascinated and will come to that. And relax. Don't have an agenda. Just see what God is saying.
And maybe even...
I mean, it's so easy to kind of throw agendas in.
Yeah.
No, we've got to have a Bible study. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. We've got to do this. Yeah. No. Just meet. Start by just meeting.
And praying. Yeah, just open up what you feel. Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
If stuff needs to be discussed, maybe just meet for an hour or two, you know, a week and so on, and have open discussion.
Yeah.
And if you want it more structured, there's plenty of material, but just start meeting. It's relational.
Yeah.
It's relational. Relationships with God, relationships with each other.
And if they wanted to dust off their Bible that they knew was around somewhere, any particular book they could read?
No. You're already setting the agenda.
Thank you. Interesting point. Just pray
then. You're already setting the agenda. Don't set the agenda. Just have the courage to actually say, okay, so we haven't got an agenda, God. Let's just pray. Let's just see what comes out.
But that sounds too basic and easy, isn't it?
Well, as I remember it, Jesus didn't say to the disciples, come, follow me, and this is what you're going to do, and this is going to be the Bible study, and this is how we're going to order it, and this is who's going to be in charge, and this is how we're going to do each day. No, he just said, come, follow me, didn't he?
I think he did, yeah. What I remember. Well, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you, Peter, and listening, more importantly, listening to what you've been saying. Very quickly then, lockdown, post-Christianity, where do you see it going?
I hope it's going that people actually start to get a heart for Christ and a heart for listening to what God is saying, and they have the courage to go with it. And that may mean not staying with, you know, the particular church or whatever, because we need radical Christianity.
That term, radical Christianity, has been bandied around for quite a few years now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, how radical can it go, though?
Well, just drop your agendas and see what God says.
Do you know what? I feel like writing a book now. Drop Your Agendas. That's got a great, great title. Peter, listen, I'm going to wrap it up there. Thank you ever so much. Before we go on to your two-minute hero, which I'm really looking forward to hearing, bearing in mind the hero has to be dead, so that we can't be accused in a few years' time. Peter Mockford chose him, and look what happened as a result. You know, that's why I choose that. If anyone would like to comment on this, our email address is ogc@accessradio.biz. Or if you have a question that I can then maybe pass on to Peter or something like that, I'm sure I can do that. The email address again is ogc@accessradio.biz. And biz is spelt B-I-Z, by the way. This has been a BCSC production. Thank you again, Peter. If you could just start off by giving us your name and who your two-minute hero is, and I'll give you the countdown. Thank you very much indeed.
Right. My name is Peter Mockford, and my real hero of faith is actually Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He had the courage to hear what God was saying, go against the institution, and he had the integrity to actually live his life in a way that actually he was prepared to pay the real sacrifice. So he is my real hero.
Peter Mockford, thank you very much indeed for joining us today.
Blessings. Thank you, Martin.